The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Oh, what have you done, girl? And it was you. Don't you lie to me. Last man coming into the way told me a gemstone hit the Father Abbot, and that all the monks were amazed that someone had struck so hard and from so far away. They had wards in place against such attacks, so it said. So they and I know the assassin was a person of great power with the stones. Only one person I know could have done that.
Avalyn Desbrus could have torn his head from his shoulders.
And Avalyn is dead. We both know that. And we know, too, who it was that has his gemstones. And one of those stones was Lodestone, was it not? And it was a Lodestone that hit the Father Abbot. So where is your Lodestone, girl?
Kilsippany has suffered greatly at the hands of Father Abbot Mongwart.
She acted rashly and without regard for greater events about her.
Events that she could not know of, since we have not contacted her.
Events that include the child in her womb? That fact alone should have stayed her hand. The Abelican Church will realize almost absolute control over the city now, and they will orchestrate every movement of King Danube, using security as an excuse. Your friend has cost us much.
Jill, the assassin.
You hit me hard, my dear.
Do you see what you have done to me? And only by the power of the gemstones am I able to paint an image of my face as it was. And only by the telepathic power of the soul stone am I able to communicate so that those around me think that I am speaking to them. I know you, and I am coming for you.
The rabbit, you must flee.
Hinder her not. And know that when this day is through, our power will be even greater in Hans the Bear. Be gone!
Don't miss the cataclysmic conclusion of the third book of the Demon Wars saga, The Demon Apostle, Part 3.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Mort Shelby, M.B. Van Dorn, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Lily David, Thomas Penny, M.J. Casey, Tom Simpson, Jeff Baker, Lily Beacon, David Coyne, James Konacek, Sonny Lasky, Scott McCormick, Tony Nam, Laura Quinn Anderson, Richard Rowan, and Nanette Savard. Survivalist number 19, Final Rain. Rain fell in drops so large they were each visible to the naked eye, even in total darkness. The rain iced over the places where the wiper blades didn't reach. It lashed against the helicopter gunship's cockpit bubble so hard, Rourke thought the crippled craft might not make the wave-lashed beach of the volcanic atoll.
Mayday! Mayday! Aircraft calling Arkhangelsk! Come in! Over!
It was the same message Paul Rubinstein had been sending since the main rotor pitch control began malfunctioning. It was the only message they could send. To give position, or for that matter, to send a longer message would be inviting triangulation and discovery by the Soviet naval forces or high-altitude Soviet observation craft under the command of Antonovich. Either enemy force's attention at the moment was something John Rourke didn't need. The helicopter was useless in its present condition.
Leave it, Paul. If they haven't picked us up by now, they're not going to. They probably figured we'd land with this weather, even considering how little they know about aircraft. Dirkwood's sub wouldn't be near enough to the surface to pick up a transmission at our sending strength, not with winds like these to navigate against. Submarines are terribly unstable in rough weather when they're on the surface. Even a monster-sized sub like that Soviet island classer. Darkwood would have to dive. He's probably riding it out down deep, waiting for the storm to subside to reestablish contact with us. He knows our approximate position, and we know his course.
Paul hung up his headset. The cockpit dome light combined with the lighted instrument panel to shed a blue-white wash over everything, even their hands, against the coal-black darkness of the storm surrounding them. John Thomas Rourke moved back along the fuselage, flipping on a bank of overhead lights as he went.
I'll go with you.
I wish you could go instead of me. But no, you stay inside. Try the pitch control when I tell you to. I don't want to go out into this more than once.
Rourke sloughed out of his battered brown bomber jacket and caught up the black German parka from the rack on the port side of the fuselage. German Arctic gear was supposed to be exceedingly waterproof. He had the feeling he was about to give it the ultimate test. Rourke pulled the parka on over his double Alessi rig with the twin stainless Detonics 45s. He closed the coat, zipping it full to his throat, the collar up. The black BDU pants he wore, mid-wake issue, supposedly had water-resistant properties as well. He'd soon find out. Rourke pulled up the parka hood, snorkeled it over his face until there was a mere circular opening. He grabbed his gloves and the toolkit. He was ready.
Keep listening for the radio, just in case Darkwood's out of this weather. I have no idea where this front came from or how extensive it is.
Rourke caught up his M16. They were deep inside enemy territory based on the mounting evidence they'd seen since joining forces with Jason Darkwood, captain of the United States nuclear submarine Ronald Wilson Reagan. Several small Soviet land bases existed on these islands, bases of Midway's historic enemy beneath the waves. The 5 centuries-old land war had been going on between forces unaware of a similar conflict beneath the sea. The submarine forces of Midway and their Soviet enemies knew nothing of life on the land. But whether under the sea or on land, the conflict was growing again into global warfare, the likes of which had not occurred since the middle of the 20th century. Despite the risk of touching down near a Soviet Marine Spetsnaz outpost, there was nothing else to do but to land, while landing was still possible. They needed to fix the pitch control, the downpour of rain and sleet be damned. If a random lightning strike contributed to the malfunction, electrical activity was frighteningly intense during the lull when the snow stopped, before the warm front moved in on heavy winds, the helicopter might be beyond repair. If the rotor was partially iced up, Rourke could jury-rig out of the main wiring harness to create a convection heater and keep the unit from re-icing and thaw it in the process. As John grabbed up the mooring lines, he felt his enthusiasm for the task ahead ebb. But time was critical. Rourke shot a wave to Paul Rubenstein and threw open the fuselage door.
Whoa!
The ferocious wind, rain, and sleet nearly knocked him to the deck. He dragged his way through, jumped to the ground, and his boots sunk into ice-encrusted snow. As soon as Rourke's hands were clear of the doorframe, Paul hauled the door to. The wind, combined with the rain, felt like standing in a waterfall. The temperature of the water hovered near freezing. Despite the water-resistant Arctic gear, Rourke's muscles began to tense with a sudden shock to his system. He started to push away from the fuselage, the wind all but hurtling him back. He angled his body into it. He put up his right arm to give more protection to the opening in the snorkel hood. The driving sleet coated the sling of his rifle and the backs of his gloves with a thin layer of ice. The BDU pants weren't adequate insulation for his legs, and the muscles across his thighs stiffened. He reached the nose of the craft. He turned into the wind, squinting against it, and picked his spot. He laid out the first mooring line and secured it to the aircraft. As he worked, the line grew stiff with ice and crackled in his hands. Then he led the line out into the wind, each step more difficult than the last. 50 feet from the chopper, he stopped. Standing on the line, lest it be whipped away in the wind, he knelt on it and fumbled open the already ice-cased toolkit. Like a combination of pitons and railroad spikes, the mooring posts were a good 8 inches in length, light in weight like aluminum. He took one from the case, closing the case after he'd removed the hammer. He set the case down and used the hammer to whack the spike into the iced-over rock of the atoll's beach perimeter. He worried the mooring spike might not be strong enough to penetrate the mixture of volcanic rock and coral remains. Yet it did after considerable effort. As he tried to pick up the tool case, Rourke realized it was frozen to the rock. He struggled with the case for several seconds before it broke free of the ice. Paul watched John through the port in the sliding door. He should have gone into the storm with John, but John was right. Someone had to be inside. The second spike was nearly in, but a nearby motion caught John's eye. He almost reached for the already ice-encrusted M16, much good that it would have done, but it was Paul.
Here! Let me do that!
John surrendered the hammer, trying to rub the stiffness from his thighs. The last spike was in. The German helicopter sat lashed as secure as they could make it against the still gale-force winds. John Rourke gestured toward the chopper. His friend gestured to himself, then toward the main rotor. Rourke shook his head. After a moment's pause, Paul nodded, clambered over one of the iced-over guy cables, and made for the gunship. Rourke stood there a moment, debating whether to pull down his hood and goggle up or tough it out without the goggles, as he had been doing. His eyebrows already felt frozen, and what little skin of his face was exposed felt numb. The thought of being soaked beneath the protection of the hood in the wind-propelled ice water was too much. He gave up on the goggles. Squinting against the driven, freezing rain again, Rourke trudged through the slush and snow for the gunship's ladder rungs. The rungs were ice-encrusted, but starting to melt. The defroster for the ladder rungs activated the moment of touchdown. Slowly, John Rourke climbed up toward the main rotor. Paul's body ached with the cold. His face tingled with it. The rain and ice pelted the skin of the gunship as Paul moved forward, seating himself at one of the two control consoles. There was something coming over the radio as he scanned the ultra-high frequency bands. It sounded like a moan, someone or something in its death agony, crying out. Paul rubbed his hands together, stared into the night. He couldn't see John anymore. The transmission he thought he heard, he told himself it was his imagination, was probably just an electronic ghost. The first time he heard one, the experience unnerved him. But with the anomalies of the atmosphere and the electrical storm and the higher altitude level they'd just abandoned, it was to be expected. Paul couldn't see John, but he could hear him overhead now. And there was more than a little reassurance in that. With the radio set on scan to pick up whatever transmission might come their way, friend or foe, or ghost again, and John not yet having signal to try the pitch control, there was nothing to do. Paul stood up and walked aft to where he stowed the few belongings he brought for the expedition. The coat he wore outside was still partially coated with ice. A puddle grew beneath where it hung, thawing. His gloves, set on the bench along the starboard bulkhead, were gnarled, twisted, and stiff. Rain and ice continued to hammer against the exterior of the helicopter. When the gusts were right, the wind nearly toppled the craft, or so it felt. The helicopter shuddered, even as John worked on top of the aircraft.
Should we moor it tighter? How could we?
Paul closed his eyes for a moment.
The important thing is that Anne, Natalia, and Otto are alive.
Paul opened his eyes. From out of his pack, he took a watertight bag. Inside it was a similar bag. He opened this as well. Inside this second layer of waterproof material, he found his journal. Paul returned to the cockpit and leafed through his journal pages before he began to write. He started his journal, or diary, while a passenger aboard the ill-fated aircraft where he first met John the very night of the war. Paul read his initial impressions of John Rourke.
A tall man. High forehead, but thick head of hair. This man claims he's a doctor of medicine. But why does a doctor of medicine know how to fly a jet aircraft? That's what he's got to be doing. Are the pilots dead because of the bomb blast near the plane? Are we all dying? This man, the doctor, there's something in his face, deep in his eyes. I saw it there as he looked along the aisle. Am I grasping at straws? Because the man's face somehow reassured me.
Through his desert travels with John Rourke to Albuquerque, the church there with the burn victims, the priest, the little girl John couldn't save, Paul chronicled it all. He wrote of the look of anger mixed with sadness in John's eyes. The journal included the account of their return journey to the downed commercial jet, a ride of a lifetime in a 57 Chevy with the Beach Boys singing on the tape deck. They returned to find the aftermath of the brigands' attack on the plane, the butchered passengers. Then Paul saw in John Rourke the steel of some man out of a spaghetti western, the few words, the fast guns, even the squint in his eyes. A blonde-haired stewardess told John she knew he'd come back. She died in John's arms. Together, Paul and John got the bodies of the dead passengers and crew together and torched the aircraft. From there, John and Paul set out on motorcycles belonging to the dead brigands. Paul Rubinstein closed his eyes, felt himself smiling. He didn't know then that there was something very special about that moment that had established the pattern for the rest of his life. John Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, together. They found the brigand encampment. John rode in alone on the back of a Harley belonging to one of the brigands. At the top of the page of his journal, the words, "Trigger Control," were written. He wasn't flattering himself that he had become a real hand with that submachine gun, the Schmeisser he carried to this very day. He learned to ride a motorcycle as well as almost any man and better than most. Falling off taught him a lot. Together, across the country, across time, John and Paul rode. From the night of the war through the great conflagration, when the skies caught fire from the ionization effects of the nuclear material suspended in the atmosphere, and through the sleep, they remained together. In 5 centuries, mankind, or what remained, came full circle, once again on the brink of global warfare. But this time, one single nuclear detonation might destroy the fragile envelope of atmosphere that partially restored itself in those 5 centuries. During those 5 centuries, John, his wife Sarah, their children Michael and Annie a grown woman now, Paul's wife, and Natalia, cryogenically, slept. Paul flipped through many pages and opened on the Eden Project. The battle to save the Eden Project almost cost Paul his life. The Soviet gunships, under the command of Vladimir Karamazov's KGB elite corps, attacked as the Eden Project space shuttles made their precarious landings. The Eden Project traveled 5 centuries on an elliptical orbit to the edge of the solar system and back. The astronauts aboard survived by means of the same cryogenic sleep that preserved the Rourke family at the retreat in the mountains of northeastern Georgia. Karamazov tried to destroy them, shoot the weaponless shuttlecraft out of the sky as they landed. Paul stared at their helicopter gunship's controls. He could fly such a ship now, not well, but fly it a little. John said he was learning quickly. Paul shivered, not from the cold, but the memory. With no experience flying a helicopter, Paul took a craft up, shot it out with the Soviet gunships. He did his bit, got wounded, his gunship crippled. Even whole, he wouldn't have known how to land. But John saved his life. The relationship with John Rourke was a little uneven from the start. Less uneven, a little at least, as time went by. Now they were brothers in all but blood. With Paul's marriage to Annie, he was now truly part of the Rourke family. Paul turned to the last entry.
Annie's alive. Today, with the help of a group of mid-wake U.S. Marine Corps and Navy personnel, we captured the Soviet island-class submarine Arkhangelsk. Jason Dockwood. It reminds me of John, the way he has of always being right. Commander, the atrocity committed by the Soviet personnel from that damn dome city beneath the Pacific is something impossible to forget. They built, then burned a pyre of human beings. Their message was clear. War. We gave them a message back. If these enemy forces combined with the land and air forces under the command of Antonovich, would we be able to stop them? Would the forces of New Germany, the gentle people of Hecla and Liebfelded Island, the meager numbers of Eden Project survivors and the Chinese of the First City combined have any chance to prevail? If Annie and I were somehow to live, where would we go in the face of the defeat of our allies? Find the mythical third Chinese city, wherever that is? Hide in the retreat for 5 more centuries? Then what? The war goes on. Will it ever end? John, though more vigorous than ever, grows weary of it, I know. I think that Natalie's nervous breakdown, if that's the right term, is the only thing that's truly frightened John Rourke. It's there, and there's nothing he can do about it. He can't find it, fight it, change it. The condition is there, and a remedy is out of his hands. God bless them both.
Paul took up his pen and wrote.
En route to Midwake, shepherding the boarded submarine Arkhangelsk, under the command of Captain Jason Dockwood, USN. We encountered a totally unexpected weather front. The leading edge of heavy, driving snow ended abruptly. Then high winds, lightning, that in all honesty scared me to death, appeared out of nowhere, heralding a rainstorm unlike anything I'd ever seen. The storm surrounds us as I write. I write now because we're grounded. Mechanical problems forced us to land on an atoll in the Pacific. Hopefully, It's only ice following the pitch control for the main rotor. John is outside finding out. I would have insisted more that I work to free the rotor, but he knows what to do. Should the problem be electronic, we'll be stuck here. It wouldn't be wise to lift off in these winds at any event. We might simply stay, wait it out. But as soon as the storm subsides enough to attempt a takeoff, we must. Our helicopter would be a sitting duck for the deck guns of one of the Soviet island-class submarines. John and I discussed what to do with the machine once we reach Midway. The only option seems to be hiding it on some nearby island, if possible. Otherwise, scuttling it and traveling below the waves with Darkwood's crew, or, perhaps by then, aboard Darkwood's own ship, USS Ronald Wilson Reagan. Darkwood's second-in-command, T.J. Sebastian, is currently commanding.
He slammed closed the journal, staring into the night. Paul was amazed at himself, trying to use the naval jargon. He thought he was sounding like a poor imitation of Stevenson or Jack London. The scanner had locked onto something.
What the?
Paul Rubenstein nearly drew the battered Browning high power from the fabric chest holster he wore.
Easy, man.
The knocking had to be John. Perhaps he was just finishing up the wiring needed for the convection heater. If that was the case, it was a good sign the problem was not from a lightning tip. Try the pitch control? Not until John was safely in view, but Paul began studying the instruments. What if the pitch control didn't work? The microphone was in a wire cradle over the illuminated chart table.
This is the captain speaking. Battle stations. I say again, battle stations. This is not a drill. I'll keep you advised.
He tossed the microphone to Aldridge, stepped up the few steps to the command chair, and sank into it, his legs stretched out. They were being enveloped by two island-class submarines of the Soviet Navy. One of the vessels hailed them on the standard Soviet emergency frequency. There would be a code, of course, and the crew currently manning the Arkhangelsk didn't know it because they were in the process of stealing it. Jason Darkwood's fingertips gouged into the armrest of the Arkhangelsk's command chair. Lance Corporal Lanigan, not perfectly qualified for the task he had been given, but someone whose abilities Jason Darkwood could trust, and as suited to manning a position on the command deck of a submarine as any of the Marine Corps or naval personnel aboard, looked back from the vessel's sonar array console.
I'm as sure of it as I can be, sir.
I'm comforted by your reassurances, Lanigan. Stand by.
Right arm slung low from the shoulder wound he'd sustained, Sam Aldridge, a Marine captain, but filling in as Darkwood's executive officer, turned from the plotting console.
Then they're on to us?
What about Rourke?
Darkwood stood up, ignoring his own question as if it were rhetorical. But it wasn't. Under the circumstances, with cyclone conditions on the surface and two island classers closing in, it might as well have been.
Sam, get over on that weapons console.
Aye, Captain.
Aldridge nodded grimly and hustled over to the weapons console. Darkwood strode to the plotting station as he gestured to the Marine at the engineering station.
Seaman Eubanks, is it?
Aye, Captain.
Can you handle this, son? We're going to be moving fast once we have to.
Yes, sir. I think so. I've been going over everything in my head.
Good, Seaman Eubanks.
The diode readings flashed the intersecting trajectories of the two island classers, time remaining until the Arkhangelsk was totally boxed in under 2 minutes, unless they or the Arkhangelsk altered speed.
Engineering, reactor status?
Port and starboard reactors full online, Captain. There's a little fluctuation in the starboard unit.
Fix it. I'll need full power when I need it. Weapons.
Aye, Captain.
Run a check on fore and aft torpedo tubes. Make sure all tubes are loaded and online. Give me the status on cluster charges.
Aye, Captain.
Darkwood narrowed his eyes as he studied the forward navigational display on the view screen. He could make out the hulking shapes of the island classers as they approached. He had intentionally avoided any evasive action to forestall the inevitable.
Lanigan, change hats and give me word on their communications.
Yes, sir.
Lanigan was ambitious, wanted to be an officer, and if he kept going, Darkwood thought he'd probably make it. With the relatively static population level of Midwake and a constant war footing, there was always the need for good officers to come up through the ranks and usually ample opportunity. If the war expanded to the land, there would be casualties in the ranks of the officer corps to fill. It was a grim thought.
They cut off the ship-to-ship communications, and I'm getting a personal appeal for Commander Stakhanov to respond, sir.
We could always try telling him he's in the head, I suppose.
Darkwood focused on the two converging lines, the two island-class submarines with which he was about to do battle. And somewhere, out there in the storm on the surface, Dr. Rourke and his friend Mr. Rubenstein were likely powerless to move if they were still alive. Jason summoned up every available piece of data he could find in the Reagan's computers dealing with aircraft. And from what he read, the chances for a helicopter survival in conditions like those on the surface weren't very good at all. The two lines were closing.
Give me split-screen forward and aft display.
The view screen at the forwardmost section of the bridge split diagonally. The Russian equivalents of fore and aft flashed discreetly but noticeably.
Captain, I've got full capabilities on all weapons panels.
Hold on to that thought.
There was open sea in their wake. The two island-classers, from the looks of it, planned to form a wedge behind the Arkhangelsk, blocking escape back the way the Arkhangelsk had come, even if there were maneuvering room in which to try.
Lanigan, try to get past their open frequencies and see if there's any transmission from somewhere up ahead of us, beyond normal range.
There was a third island-classer. Darkwood was certain. The two whose courses were plotting out on the display were getting ready to send him straight into number three. There were several choices. Surrender and death he immediately ruled out as unacceptable. Though such a decision narrowed the possibilities dramatically, there were still possibilities. TJ Sebastian swung the captain's chair left.
Communications. Anything from the Arkhangelsk?
Lieutenant Mott turned away from his console.
Nothing, Mr. Sebastian. Just the same communications patterns as before. Some ship-to-ship from what sounds like two island-classers. But that's getting a lot more irregular, and it's in battle code. And they're repeating requests to speak personally with this Commander Stakhanov on the Arkhangelsk.
Very good, Lieutenant. Keep me advised of anything new.
He turned toward the warfare station.
Lieutenant Walensky, status on the torpedo tubes?
Forward torpedo status tubes 1, 2, 3, and 4 loaded with high explosive independent ensign, Mr. Sebastian. Aft torpedo tubes 1, 2, 3, and 4 loaded with HEIS as well, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant.
Sebastian stood, descended the three steps from the command chair to the illuminated plotting board at the almost exact center of the con. He studied the glowing patterns for the two known enemy island-class submarines and the third line on which the first two were rapidly closing. That third line showed the course of the Arkhangelsk under the command of Jason Darkwood. Sebastian pulled down the intership communications microphone.
This is Commander Sebastian speaking. Now hear this. Battle stations. Say again, battle stations. This is not a drill.
Sebastian replaced the microphone in its nest in the overhead.
Communications. Anything new?
Nothing new, sir. Same patterns.
Sonar. Still picking up that ghost.
Lieutenant Kelly didn't look up from the console.
I'm still on it, sir. It might just be that, sir. Just a ghost.
Unlikely, I think.
Sebastian eyed the intersecting lines of light on the plotting board. It was a trap for the Arkhangelsk. That much seemed evident, but he would have to be very careful while aiding the Arkhangelsk, lest the Reagan fall into the trap as well. John Rourke carefully sipped the coffee as his hand shook from the cold. Paul Rubinstein, at the controls of the still-grounded German gunship, activated the main rotor. The gunship vibrated, almost pulsed, as the wind and rain buffeted it. The chopper strained at its moorings. Rourke's coffee nearly spilled all over his hands.
Jeez.
John wouldn't have felt the heat. His fingers were nearly numb.
I'm getting a little response, John. I think what you did worked.
Well, keep the main rotor idling, Paul. That'll speed up the de-icing and keep us from running down our batteries.
With studied effort, John set down the cup, the coffee within an almost perfect study in wave motion, just not quite spilling over the edge. The M16 needed cleaning, but not until the metal warmed to the touch. There were other weapons to hand. There was no rush with the main rotor pitch control defrosting, because until the winds died down, only an idiot or a desperate man with a death wish would attempt a takeoff. Annie escaped the debriefing as quickly as possible. Some sort of message came in that distressed Mr. Sebastian and the rest of the crew, including ship's Dr. Maggie Barrow. It was due to the Reagan's Dr. Barrow that Annie had clothes to wear. She felt awkward walking around in a rankless uniform and more conspicuous than a sore thumb. The navy blue sundress was one of three outfits sent to her with a little note.
Sorry I have to run out on you, Annie. See you when I get back. Trust Dr. Rothstein. He's the best.
Maybe he was, but she was scared to death. So why did she ask to meet him as soon as possible? Annie shook her head, put down the sundress, and sat on the edge of the bed, just in her slip. It was a full slip, so either Maggie Barrow had similar taste in clothing or was very perceptive, perhaps both. The women of Midway dressed like the women she saw in videotapes at the retreat. Pretty dresses, high-heeled shoes, feminine-looking,
as if things froze in time 5 centuries ago, when the then few scientists and researchers and naval and marine personnel stationed in Midwake were cut off from the rest of the world on the night of the war.
The women here probably watch the same old movies I do.
Annie stood up again.
No, not the sundress.
Even though it always looked more or less like daylight here, it was nighttime. Annie changed stockings from sheers to black opaque. She then dressed in a gray long-sleeved blouse with 6 covered buttons at each cuff and a collar that tied into a floppy bow. Annie pulled on a black skirt, flared, below mid-calf length. Finally, she slipped into black high-heeled shoes. As seldom as she wore such things, they felt somehow natural to her. Natalia's influence? Annie hurried. No jewelry to put on.
Understated elegance doesn't require jewelry.
She arranged her hair over her shoulders and drawn back in a barrette at the crown of her head. She looked at herself one last time in the mirror.
Knock 'em dead.
Annie opened the door to her room to find the 2 female shore patrol waiting just outside to escort her to the appointment. The thought of it made her stomach churn. Commander T.J. Sebastian approached the periscope array.
Mr. Tagachi, attack periscope.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Seaman First Class Morris Tagachi worked his control panel, the handles folded down. Sebastian peered through the device.
More computer enhancement, Mr. Tagachi.
Aye, sir.
Lurking in the shadows beyond where he could say with any certainty that what he saw was really there, he saw movement. A school of large fish whisked suddenly upward. He could have sworn he saw a black shadow and a wake.
Down periscope, Mr. Tagachi.
Sebastian moved quickly across the deck, ascending the 3 steps, and settled himself into the command chair. He activated the correct armrest control.
Computer, this is Commander Sebastian.
Voice print identity confirmed. Proceed, Commander Sebastian.
Sebastian almost said Lieutenant Commander, even though he held in his hand Admiral Ron's orders for his promotion. But how did the computer know? An interesting question, but no time to probe for an answer.
Analysis of Soviet progress and efforts toward achieving total sonar masking?
Processing.
Sebastian focused his gaze on the illuminated plotting board. It was out there, a 4th island-class submarine. Jason Darkwood commanded 1, 2 more pursued Darkwood's command, and 1 more. Sebastian could feel it.
Soviet progress toward total sonar masking cannot be readily assessed. September 18th, 2426... Derelict Soviet sonar drag array discovered off the Aleutian Trench. Said array contained component elements unfamiliar when compared with previous Soviet sonar equipment. December 26th, 2431. Reference Zeleznyo-Drozhny cipher. Decrypted transmission between Soviet Marine Spetsnaz headquarters and Soviet island-class submarine Topsiba, vessel subsequently sunk in action with United States submarine vessels Ronald Wilson Reagan and John Wayne November 11, 2439, referred to successful testing of Project Potemkin by island-class submarine Mikhailova off the Yap Trench. USS George Herbert Walker Bush, on routine patrol off Yurupik Atoll in the Caroline Islands, detected no island-class submarine present, although there were reports of numerous Scout-class submarines active in vicinity of the bush. Midwake Naval Scientific Research Institute staff report submitted February 14, 2441, summary conclusion. The Soviet Navy is implementing an intensive research and development program toward the goal of perfecting sonar invisible undersea craft capable of evading conventional sensing devices employed and currently under development by the United States Naval Forces for the purposes of detecting and interdicting enemy activity. Summary ends.
Thank you, computer. Request satisfied.
Sebastian turned to his navigator, Lieutenant Junior Grade Lorene Bowman.
Helm.
Aye, sir.
Alter the already laid-in evasive action course to include a 3rd enemy vessel, approximately 600 yards off the portside bow and proceeding toward interception of the Arkhangelsk.
3, Mr. Sebastian.
Your aural acuity has not failed you, navigator. We see 2 vessels, but there are, in fact, 3.
He was gambling, not something he was wont to do. But if he were going to gamble, he would indulge in the time-honored tradition of hedging his bet.
Lieutenant Walensky.
His weapons officer turned to him in response, but he didn't wait.
Confirm status on all torpedo tubes as well as port and starboard cluster charges.
He dismissed his words as accomplished until she told him otherwise.
Engineering.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Mr. Hartnett. Satisfy me that port and starboard reactors are ready for full power into maximum. Prepare for overdrive on demand.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Hartnett nodded as he pushed his splayed fingers back through his thick dark hair. Captain Jason Darkwood might attempt the maneuver his father accomplished so successfully some 40 years before during the renowned Battle of Miner's Reef. Recently, Jason himself updated the ploy in the battle that accomplished the rescue of Captain Aldridge and other prisoners escaping the Soviet underwater complex, including Dr. John Thomas Rourke. What worked against Admiral Suvorov, and later against a hastily assembled pursuit wolf pack, might not work in a well-laid trap. If Jason Darkwood, aboard the Arkhangelsk, was unaware of the significant likelihood a third submarine waited for him, he would either sail right into its torpedoes or, perhaps worse, collide with it while the Arkhangelsk's engines were reaching overdrive status. Jason hadn't attempted the maneuver with a craft so much bulkier and more sluggish in response. The island-classers were not so fast to the helm as their American counterparts. How could Jason Darkwood calculate for the difference in such a maneuver? Sebastian shook his head. He had more important work to do than second-guessing Jason.
Commander, torpedo tubes fore and aft are fully armed with HEIS. Cluster charges armed.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
There was no need to tell Louise Walensky to be ready for battle. She lived for it, Sebastian sometimes thought. He, on the other hand, did not. Battle was an unfortunate consequence of his profession. That human beings had no recourse but to hunt one another like wild creatures of the sea was inexcusable, insane. To be a party to the insanity was only necessary to the extent it secured the survival of his country. Sebastian looked to the plotting board. He could see the Arkhangelsk, just about to be cut off from retreat. His fists balled over the armrests of his borrowed chair. He wished Jason Darkwood sat in it now.
Communications. Broadcast to the Arkhangelsk in the most recent code where certain our adversaries have definitely broken that the United States submarine Ronald Wilson Reagan is coming to her aid in anticipated battle with two enemy vessels.
Two, sir? But I thought...
Transmit as given, Lieutenant Mott. Continue to broadcast this message until answered or we are engaged.
Aye, sir.
The next move was Jason Darkwood's, unless the enemy preempted. It was unnecessary to direct Lieutenant Mott that should the Arkhangelsk give a reply, if Jason Darkwood had the time, he would reply, to pay particular attention to the accuracy with which the message was copied.
Seaman Tagachi?
Aye, sir.
Raise the attack periscope in case we're being watched.
Sir?
Do it, mister.
Sebastian descended the three steps and stood before the plotting board.
Computer.
He wasn't speaking to a disembodied entity within the ship's electronic circuitry. He was speaking to Computer Station Chief Lieutenant Junior Grade Rodriguez.
Aye, sir.
Mr. Rodriguez, consult with the ship's computer banks and calculate as precisely as possible the maximum acceleration factor for an island-class submarine traveling at one-third flank speed, shifting into reverse maneuvering speed. Take into account such variables as the response time of inexperienced con personnel, and to the best of your ability, also consider the factor that the man at the helm of said island-classer is Captain Darkwood.
Aye, sir.
Sebastian studied the converging lines. They were nearly met. Within moments, Jason Darkwood would be forced to act.
Commander!
Yes, Mr. Mott.
Sebastian turned to the communication station.
Sir, I just received a message from Captain Darkwood aboard the Arkhangelsk.
Share it with me, Mr. Mott.
Aye, sir. Compliments to Admiral Ron, commanding USS Ronald Reagan. Advise protect your flagship at all costs. Project Damocles device installed and operational. Just watch and enjoy. Two enemy vessels about to be destroyed. Signed, Darkwood, Captain, USN, USS Roy Rogers, formerly Soviet submarine vessel Arkhangelsk, commanding.
T.J. Sebastian smiled.
Sir? What's Project Damocles?
Sebastian kept the smile. He remembered seeing old videotapes of the man known as the King of the Cowboys.
I believe, Mr. Mott, Captain Darkwood's wishing us happy trails. Let us endeavor to see to it that his wish comes true.
He returned to the plotting display. In the next instant, Jason Darkwood would have to make his move.
Communications. Convey Admiral Ron's compliments to the USS Roy Rogers, using the same code, of course, and inform Captain Darkwood that the fleet is in readiness.
Jason knew about the third island-class submarine. Jason Darkwood stood over the unfamiliar plotting table.
Seaman Eubanks, confirm with engineering that reactors are full online and ready.
Aye, sir.
Sam, be ready with port and starboard cluster charges on my signal.
Aye, sir.
Corporal Lanigan, signal to Reagan that the U.S. Roy Rogers is ready to deploy on Admiral Ron's command.
Darkwood moved to the navigation station. He laid his hands over the instruments. Island-classers were unresponsive beasts, but this one had to respond.
Engineering, ready?
Aye, sir.
Excellent. On my mark, full power. I don't care if we fry the damned reactors, because if we don't get full power, we're dead, right?
Aye, sir.
Very good, Seaman Eubanks.
Darkwood didn't take his eyes from his instruments, his left hand poised over speed controls.
Sam, look at that plotting board real quick. Where are they?
Maybe 100 yards off our stern, Jason.
Right, resume your station, Sam. Be ready on those cluster charges. Fire on my mark to engineering. Then be ready to follow up with tubes 1 and 3 forward. Be sure of your targets. We don't want to hit the Reagan. Or, for that matter, any of Admiral Ron's invisible fleet. You got all that?
Aye, Captain.
We'll make a sailor out of you yet, Sam.
Begging the captain's pardon, but like hell.
Darkwood closed his left hand over the speed control. He was counting it out in his head, calculating speed versus time. 50 yards to either side of him. If the cluster charges went off too quickly, the Roy Rogers would be squashed flatter than a piece of paper. On the plus side, Darkwood reassured himself, he'd be dead so quickly he'd never feel it. Darkwood flexed the fingers of his left hand, his head nodding, his eyes closed.
40 yards. Dun, 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 dun. 30 yards. Dun, 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 dun. 20 yards. Boom! Mark, gentlemen. Engineering and weapon stations.
Darkwood hauled the speed control from all ahead 1/3 to reverse. If he didn't break something, maybe there was a chance.
Fire the damn cluster charges, Sam.
Fire, Jason.
More power, engineering. Fry those reactors.
The deck beneath him seemed to vibrate, and for a moment, just a split second, he had the impression of something akin to a loss of gravity as the island classer suddenly changed course. Darkwood's instruments were redlining, but they were showing reverse. The cluster charges detonated, then, erratically, like Soviet cluster charges sometimes did, too soon, the Arkhangelsk swept off trim.
Engineering, more power or we're dead! Tell the reactor crew I need everything we've got and I need it right now! Move!
Darkwood rammed the controls to all back over the banging sounds of the cluster charges exploding around them and a steadily rising hum from the screws.
Sam, read that plotting board quick!
We're dead even with their prows, Jason.
Be ready with those torpedoes. Don't fire until I give the word.
If they made it clear of the two island classers without being ripped open like a can of fish or squashed, he'd fire two of the forward torpedo tubes and maneuver out of the way. If.
Helm, blow ballast in the starboard tanks to get trim back. If.
Sebastian left the plotting board. He sat in the captain's chair.
Helm, implement the course corrections I gave you now. All ahead full, up 60 feet as we go.
Aye, Mr. Sebastian.
Sebastian swung the chair left toward Lieutenant Walensky.
Warfare, prepare to fire forward tubes 1 and 3 on my command.
At what, sir?
You'll have a target shortly, Sonar. Lieutenant Kelly, any activity coming our way?
With all the cluster charges coming off the Arkhangelsk, sir, I can't... Wait a minute, sir! We've got two wire guides coming right at us, but not from either one of the two island classers.
Time to intercept for the wire guides, Lieutenant?
Time to intercept? 17 seconds.
Very good, Lieutenant. Helm, lock into Sonar's readouts and do a running plot taking us away from the wire guides and toward the two visible island classers as was our original intent. Engineering, stand by for evasive maneuvers and notify reactor crews to stand by for overdrive.
15 seconds and closing, sir.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Warfare, back azimuth the two wire guides and fire torpedoes 1 and 3 at the exact center of the plot, compensating for full flank speed of the island classer toward the visible island classers.
Aye, sir. Calculating.
Helm, we're running out of time.
I've got it laid in, sir. 12 seconds and closing, sir.
Engineering, prepare for overdrive.
Overdrive capability standing by, sir.
Navigator, ready.
Aye, sir.
Warfare, ready.
Aye, sir. 12 seconds, sir.
Warfare, you may fire at will.
Aye, sir. Firing sequence commencing now.
Somehow he could always sense the release of a torpedo, some subtle vibration in the Reagan's hull, perhaps only imagined. Sebastian turned his eyes toward Mott.
Communications. On intraship, advise the crew to stand by for collision quarters.
Aye, sir.
Now hear this. Stand by for collision quarters. Say again. Stand by for collision quarters.
Engineering, activate overdrive power.
Aye, sir. Activating overdrive now.
Tubes 1 and 3 away, sir.
Sebastian shifted his gaze to the plotting table. He could see the Arkhangelsk's position. The pincer formation of the two island classers outflanking her, broken. The Arkhangelsk free. But to do what?
Position of those wire guides, Sonar.
11 seconds. Now 12. Now 13.
Notify me if we reach 10 seconds again.
Aye, sir.
Helm, prepare for the disengagement of overdrive.
Ready to disengage, sir.
I copy that, sir.
Disengage.
Aye, sir. Disengaging.
Aye, sir. Disengaging.
All back. Take us up 100 feet as quickly as possible, Lieutenant.
Aye, sir. All back. Blowing air to port and starboard main ballast tanks. We're coming up, sir.
Sonar, the wire guides.
11. 10. 9.
Navigation. All ahead 2/3, 5 degrees left rudder and up 50 feet. Warfare. Ready cluster charges. We're going in on the two visible island classers.
I have readouts on torpedo firing, sir.
Did we hit, Lieutenant?
Confirmed on 1/3 is... We hit, sir.
Premature. Sonar, positions on those wire guides.
Just under us, sir. Past us.
Helm, all back. Hard right rudder. Bring her about 180 degrees, then go to all ahead full.
All back, sir. Hard right rudder, bringing her about to all ahead full.
Very good. Sonar, what's happening?
The Arkhangelsk is firing torpedoes. One of the Soviet island classers is hurt.
Helm, plot the best intercept course to the second island classer. Notify warfare when we are in torpedo range. Communications, advise the crew to secure from collision quarters, maintain battle stations.
Aye, sir.
Now hear this.
Secure from collision quarters. Maintain battle stations. Say again. Secure from collision quarters. Maintain battle stations.
Warfare coming in range for torpedoes on my mark. Mark, understood. Sir, we are in range for firing remaining forward torpedoes.
Calculate optimum firing sequence and fire at will, Lieutenant. Communications. Signal the Arkhangelsk that Admiral Ron sends his compliments.
Aye, sir.
Firing 3 and 4, sir.
Acknowledge, Lieutenant. Stand down on cluster charges.
Standing down on cluster charges.
Helm, as soon as torpedoes in tubes 2 and 4 are away, alter course 5 degrees right rudder. Bring us to within 500 yards of the Arkhangelsk and 100 feet over her.
Aye, Captain. Sorry, sir.
You have your orders, Bowman.
Aye, sir.
Sebastian didn't want to be captain.
Tubes 2 and 4 away, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant.
Sir, I'm getting a distress signal from the second island classer. She's...
Convey my regrets, Mr. Mott.
Commander T.J. Sebastian looked away.
Stupidity.
The gunship's electronic control panel came online.
John!
I'm right behind you.
John Rourke focused on the panel. It was self-orienting and indicated unknown people approaching from the north, but carrying a considerable amount of metal on their bodies to activate the system so violently. Rourke looked to the anemometer readings. Wind speed fluctuated between lows of 26 miles per hour to gusts in the 50s. To take off now was still suicidal.
Suit up, Paul.
Annie sat with her hands folded in her lap, her eyes on the painting hanging on the wall behind Dr. Rothstein's desk. It was a copy of Van Gogh's Potato Eaters. Her mother once told her Van Gogh was a great artist, but Annie was more like her father in that respect. She liked Remington and Russell and Delacroix. As the door opened, Annie edged forward in her chair, her back not touching it at all. She turned her head so she could look over her shoulder, her hands motionless. A tall, very lean man, underweight perhaps, entered the room. He wore a sports shirt, trousers, and white shoes. His short, graying brown hair was thinning on top. Like a psychiatrist in a videotape, he wore a small goatee at the tip of his chin and a pencil-thin mustache.
Mrs. Rubinstein?
Yes, sir. Dr. Rothstein.
Yes. I feel we have some ethnicity in common.
My husband, Paul, yes, he's...
He must have been happy to learn that he wasn't the only Jew left in the world.
Dr. Rothstein extended his hand as he stood before her.
He was.
Well then, I've been reading the data on you and Major Chemirovna. Am I pronouncing her name correctly? My Russian's always been terrible.
Close enough, Doctor. Do you think...
I can try.
He crossed to stand behind his desk for a second, then sat in the comfortable-looking chair behind it.
That's all anyone can do, Mrs. Rubinstein. I understand from Dr. Barrow's case notes that you are willing to help. By the way, she made an excellent diagnosis. For lack of a better explanation, Major Chemirovna is suffering the classic symptoms of manic depression, but I feel that under the surface, there's quite a bit more. What Dr. Barrow suggested has been done before. Granted, but never in a case so severe. And, of course, I'll have to test your ESP abilities.
They're very good.
Annie looked down at her hands and saw a piece of white lint on her skirt, wondering if she should pick it off and risk being thought a compulsive.
So I understand. Have you ever been hypnotized?
Not really, but I'm willing if it will help.
You must understand something, Mrs. Rubinstein, and please feel free to ask any questions you care to. You see, if I'm able to successfully hypnotize you, and you are able to read Major Chermirovna's thoughts, the only way it will do any good is for me to essentially attempt to record her thoughts in your mind. That means your own thoughts will have to be totally sublimated. There is always the danger.
He looked down at his desk. She watched how his hands moved.
Natalia's my friend, Doctor.
There is a very real danger that the shock to your mind could be such that your mind is overtaken by her symptoms. You'll essentially be living whatever she's living in her mind. I've only had the chance to spend a few moments with Major Chermirovna, but based on my initial impressions, she is entrenched in the depressive stage. Whatever her mind is experiencing, whatever feedback she's getting, it can't be pleasant. There is always the chance that whatever shocked her into this condition, whatever thing, how subtle, pushed her over the edge, as they say, might push you as well. Rather than healing Major Chermirovna, you might be dooming yourself.
dooming?
Annie swept away the piece of white lint on her skirt.
What do you mean?
With all the strides medicine and psychiatry have made in the 5 centuries since the Great War, surprisingly little more has been learned about the deeper recesses of the human subconscious. If your extrasensory abilities are as indicated, you offer the field of psychiatric study a great opportunity to actually see into the mind of the afflicted person. But since no experiment of this magnitude has ever been attempted, at least here, because we have no idea what the Russians are doing, of course, there is no way to precisely calculate the risks to you.
I'm willing to try.
What would your husband say, Mrs. Rubenstein?
Are women at Midwake legal minors, Doctor?
I never said that, but it might be wise
Since I know what my husband would say, I don't need to discuss it with him. I'm a free person. I don't need his permission. So what's next?
Well, Mrs. Rubenstein, the tests, for example...
I can start them immediately.
Dr. Rothstein stood up, as though ending the interview.
Nonsense. You'll need...
Several days to rest and recuperate.
Not much of a trick, Mrs. Rubenstein.
Think of something very intimate.
I'm not going to play games with you, Mrs. Rubenstein.
Do it.
She stood up, her fingers on his desktop.
I won't do anything until we're ready.
You just did. You wondered how it would be to have sex with me.
Mrs. Rubenstein.
You thought of the first girl you ever had sex with. Her name was Mary, or Marta, or Martha. And you were in her parents' apartment, and her younger sister was asleep in the next room.
Damn it, Mrs. Rubenstein!
She'd never done that before. She sank back into the chair, a headache exploding behind her eyes.
Oh. Oh.
John Rourke's limbs shook with the cold. There were 8 men coming from the north. The action of the M16 protected under his gloved hands, he knelt in the slush deep within the rocks. What sort of electronic sensing equipment did these Soviet personnel have available? Could they tell that one man waited for them in the rocks to intersect their line of march with a rifle? And that another waited for them near the helicopter gunship? Did they know what a helicopter gunship was? John Rourke had no answers, only questions. They were too far away for sure kills. The ranging devices in his night vision goggles confirmed what his senses and experience already knew. He watched and waited. 8 men. But coming from where? How many men behind them? He wasn't even certain the name of this island. With so many so close and no additional readings, precision was impossible. In any event, all that mattered right now was the group of figures moving his way. Sarah Rourke made coffee, giving up on adjusting her body's circadian rhythm to local time. If she'd been alone, or if only the members of her family were around her, she would have changed into something more comfortable. All she wanted now was to strip off the damned BDU pants, slip into a nightgown, and scratch her pregnant stomach. It would have been more than a bit unseemly with Wolfgang Mann, the injured Akira Kuranami, and 2 of Mann's soldiers in the retreat with her. She crossed behind the counter to get cups. With the counter masking her from view, she sneaked a scratch of her abdomen. It felt good.
Sarah?
It was Colonel Mann. She turned toward the sound of his voice. The commander of New Germany's armed forces studied the retreat's electronic monitoring system. Sarah's husband, John, recently upgraded it with German equipment, but it looked much the same as in those pre-dawn moments 5 centuries earlier when she watched the sky catch fire, ball lightning roll across the ground, and a Soviet KGB elite corps force sent to destroy her and her entire family wiped clean from the face of the earth.
What is it, Wolf?
She still felt a little awkward calling him by his first name, let alone a nickname, but he insisted she use it.
The more I learn about your husband, the more remarkable I find him. The electronic security system here is amazing, not in its equipment, but the use of such equipment, the innovation it displays.
Oh, he's always been very smart.
More than smart, as you say. If there were the opportunity now, it would be wonderful if he were to devote his mind to new challenges, not just staying alive.
Well, he's always seen staying alive as the ultimate challenge, I guess. That's the only reason this place exists, Colonel. And John is also the only reason Michael, Annie, and I still exist.
I suppose you're right.
Would you like some coffee? I made enough for you and your men.
That would be very pleasant, Frau Rourke. Sarah...
It would be time to check on Akira Kuranami in a few minutes, but not yet.
This place, its very concept, amazes me.
Mann sat down on a stool on the opposite side of the kitchen counter. Sarah Rourke looked past him, out across the great room, its books, its music, the video library, and the gun cabinets.
I never wanted him to build this place. Every spare dime we had, every spare minute he had, went into building this. Then, when the night of the war came, he was away. I'd sent him away, really. We were going to try things again. I didn't think it would work, but we'd always loved each other. And Michael and Annie were so little then.
Sarah Rourke felt a brief pang of anger and regret. That her husband robbed her of experiencing her children's youths with something she would never forget, though she wanted to forgive. Now there was another chance with their next child. Did John make her pregnant because of that, to give her a second chance at raising a child?
And you spent much of the period immediately following the bombings endeavoring to reunite. It is a fabulous story, Sarah, and that you were able to find one another.
After the night of the war, I realized John wasn't waiting for disaster, like I'd always thought, but simply preparing for it. I saw he was right. I never thought mankind could be so insane. Despite the crisis that brought it about, East-West tensions were easing. That was the real insanity of it all, and we'll never know who pushed the button. That damn button.
There were disaffected elements on both sides. Those who truly saw war as inevitable and wished to hasten it along before supposed weaknesses they saw in their own sides became more serious, irreparable. It was one of those who pushed the button, you damn, Sarah. Why do you...
She looked at him across the lip of her coffee cup.
Before the night of the war, the majority of the planet's population was comprised of women and children, Colonel, not men. I always wondered why a minority decided the fate of the majority.
He just looked at her, looked away for an instant, and smiled defensively as he looked back.
That is merely the natural order of things, Sarah.
She looked at him.
I see. Is a belief in a natural hierarchy of things, especially people, simply because of the way they were born, is that the Nazi part of your education coming out?
He looked wounded, true hurt in his eyes. He fought to make New Germany and Argentina a free nation, fought and risked everything to depose the Nazi Party and the dictator at its head. He was a liberator.
Oh, what I mean, Colonel, is who says there's a natural order to things like that? Let's look at it in simpler terms. Those few men, let's say they weren't all men, that some of them were women, those people who wanted war. Whoever pushed the button, and whatever group they represented, who gave that person the right to play God?
No one, Frau Rourke.
Wolfgang.
Sarah set down her coffee cup, held both his hands in hers.
That same mentality is at work today. This instant. People who are willing to risk total annihilation just to have their way. That's why Akira was injured. That's why John and Paul are off looking for Annie and Natalia and your Captain Hammerschmidt. That's why Michael, Maria Leuten, Bjorn Rolvag, and your volunteers are in Iceland trying to forestall something terrible happening to the people of the Hecla community. Because others choose to play God. Wolf, no one has that right.
As she looked away from his eyes and across the expanse of the retreat, she didn't say, not even John Rourke, but she thought it.